Willkommen beim Wanderful Podcast Yoga Beyond the Asana. Ich bin Wanda Badwal. Ich freue mich, gemeinsam mit dir die faszinierende Welt des Yoga, der Spiritualität und persönlichen Weiterentwicklung zu entdecken, zu hören und zu erfahren, wie wir mehr Liebe, Balance und Erfüllung in unserem täglichen Leben integrieren können. Schön, dass du hier bist.
Welcome to Yoga Beyond the Asana, the wonderful podcast. I'm so happy that you're here. I'm very excited to have a super interesting and wise man on the show today. His name is Max Strom, or in German, we would say Max Strom. Some of you who are already a little bit longer around in the yoga world might know him. But I would really like to officially introduce Max Strom to each one of you. Max Strom is a global speaker, trainer, and author, known for teaching breathing patterns and personal transformation worldwide. His method is known to help alleviate anxiety, PTSD, and sleep disorder. He has authored two books, A Life Worth Breathing, and There's No Happy. App to Happiness. Max has presented three TEDx events, and recently he presented at the World Government Summit in Dubai and the Inner Peace Conference in Amsterdam. In this podcast, I will speak with Max about the importance of breath and how our emotions and our breath are always connected. We speak about our modern day symptoms of anxiety, panic attacks, and depression, and why it is so important to feel all of our feelings, especially the hard ones. We speak about integrating childhood wounds in order to live a happy and healthy life. I'm really grateful to have met Max, and I'm super happy to present to you now this interview, which felt very from the heart, and I really hope you receive the same warm feeling I got through the conversation with Max. So enjoy listening now. So Max Strom, welcome to the podcast. I'm so happy that you're here. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for inviting me. It's my honor.
So my first question for you, Max, is what moves you right now in your life?
What moves me? What moves me? So many things in this life move me. I live out in nature now. I live in a pastoral landscape. I moved here after living in cities for some years, and I'm moved by nature very much. I'm moved by beauty, particularly inner beauty that shines through people's eyes. I am moved by music. Certain types of music, of course. We all have different frequencies when it comes to music. And I'm moved when I see people tell the truth, even if it's painful to say it. And I'm moved to see people be courageous enough to take real steps to heal and to let themselves be vulnerable and show their heart to everyone, even if they have tears in their eyes.
Very beautiful. Thank you. I was in order to prepare for this podcast, I was reading on your website and watching your podcast and or listening to some podcasts, watching your TED talk. And what stood out for me on your website is how openly you share your story. Your personal story, and I would love to hear a little bit more about it because I was really touched by it, and I felt immediately connected to you by you saying that you always felt you were the odd one in school. I actually felt the same. You know, I think many people can relate, feeling like I stand out, I'm not fitting in. So can you tell us a little bit about how you grew up?
Yeah, I always find that question extremely difficult. I'm happy to answer it, but I always find it difficult because I think none of us really see our life the way other people see it. And we sometimes, I don't find things particularly interesting that other people find very interesting, and vice versa. Some things I think are very interesting about my life that others don't understand. So I'm not always sure what to say, but I guess I can begin to say I was a 12-pound baby, which is, I don't know what that is in kilograms, but it's,
I'm not sure.
The average baby is 6.5 pounds. So I was almost double the size of an average baby.
Oh yeah. Wow.
As a pregnant lady, you can understand what this would mean if you knew this was coming. And my feet were called club feet. So they were turned inside out almost, you know, they were like this when I was a baby. So I had to spend a lot of my childhood as a very big child. I had casts on my feet. You know this term, casts, plaster, and braces and surgeries up until 9 years old. And so this, of course, taught me a lot about confinement, holding still, not being able to go outside like the other children, pain, physical pain. And my parents, my father was German. He was from Offenbach. He was 17 years old in the last year of the war. So he was not actually in fighting, but he was in the destruction of Germany, basically, and was in a concentration camp himself, like a lot of the soldiers were after the war. So he suffered there, and then the starvation, you know. And he moved to the United States in the early 1950s. He married my mother, who was American. So I have an American mother, a German father. And so the upbringing that I had was somewhat more European than standard American upbringing. But I'm very different than my parents. And I want to say something personal about them because it ties into my teaching a lot, which is, I was brought up in a house where we didn't know how to talk about emotions, where I think I only saw my mother cry twice in my life, for example. And so I learned the same thing, that if I felt pain or shame or fear or anger, that to push it down. And I had no idea how to express it or to talk about uncomfortable things. This is also an important part of my upbringing, which I had to overcome, and I'm still overcoming. And then finally, I would say, I grew up to be a very big, strong young man, athletic. I could run with my feet. After all the problems with my feet, I could run quite fast. And I played American style football in school, and I was very good at it. And people praised me for being very strong and very athletic, but my personality is more, a romantic. I'm referring to the romantic movement of the 1800s, you know, so music, poetry, philosophy is what I was interested in. So my personality didn't fit the stereotype of what people saw me as. And at age 15, I started to study comparative psychology, philosophy, poetry, college level comparative philosophies and religion. And I just read all the time when I wasn't doing everything else. So I started very early asking, what is life? Why is life? What happens after we die? I started meditating at age 16, Qigong at age 18. And I didn't discover Hatha Yoga until 1991, until I was 35 years old. So I started late with Hatha Yoga. But I already had a background in breathing and Qigong and meditation. That's the very short version of my so far little life.
Thank you for bringing that together. I know it's really hard to bring this long life to bring it to the point. I think your story is very encouraging in many ways. So one question that arose for me was, when you, because I think many people can relate, you know, maybe perceiving differently, being super sensitive, being interested in, you know, the big questions of life in an early age, having connection to the spiritual world. Mm-hmm. So if you could travel back to your young age, one that felt, you know, a little bit left out or not fitting in, what would you tell that boy moving back from now?
I would tell him so much, Vanda. I would tell him so much. I would have to sit him down and say, to trust yourself more. Believe in your direction. Believe in these interests. Follow them with all of your heart, even if people laugh or say that you are ridiculous or if your father shames you for it or your mother is completely confused by it. Just keep going. Do it. Because this will bring you great happiness, and it's the path that you should be on, a path of transcendence and of healing and helping to heal other people. That's what you should do. And you're going to be so glad that you did, that you're going to be so fulfilled by it. It'll bring you such meaning. Don't hesitate at all. This is what I would say. The first thing I would say.
So first you took another path. You said you started your yoga teaching career at age 35. So I think also that is very encouraging because I think many people these days think they have to be super young to become a yoga teacher.
Yes, right.
Right? Yeah. So before you took some other path, right? I read you were a singer in a band. You were very into music, screenwriting.
Yes, I I'm very musical. And I was in my first band at age 18. And we play very sort of romantic classical mix, classical fusion with rock. That was my first version. And then later, once we hit the 80s, I was in more of a techno rock genre. And I had two records out in the early 80s. And I loved writing, recording, producing more than performing. Because I'm not an extrovert by nature, but we did tour and do all that. I took a year off after working very hard for very many years to write a screenplay, and my screenplay got a lot of attention in Hollywood. So I moved down there, and I realized that I was so exhausted from being in the music business because if you don't make much money, it's just absolutely exhausting to continue to do the writing, the recording, the touring, the publicity, the interviews, all that. And you make like $2 a year for doing all that. You live in poverty, basically. It's very socially pleasant, but I realized I could be creative in this way, sit alone in a room with a typewriter. I started with a typewriter, not a computer, a typewriter. And just in case some of your listeners don't know what that is, it's one that makes lots of noise. Tick, 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 tick. And I thought, God, comparatively, this is so much easier. I can just sit and write the screenplay. So I ended up for 9 years writing movies. And I just completely changed. I went from one completely insecure career to another one. And but I made a living doing it for a number of years. I learned a lot. I learned how to write, of course. And I also learned that the movie business is quite corrupt, as the music business was. Not the part that I was in, but the money part. And once I started practicing yoga while I was a writer, I was very lucky, Vanda, in that I found a studio up the street from where I used to write every day from my apartment. And the studio was Yoga Works, which is up till recently a 300 school chain. And this was the first one, and they only had one room when I started there. So this was like the epicenter of yoga in America in the early 90s. It was the absolute perfect place to be to learn yoga. Rod Stryker was teaching there, and Eric Schiffman, and many other teachers that became very popular, like Brian Kest, Sean Korn. Sean Korn was a baby teacher at that point. Shiva Ray was there. And I started practicing there every day, 6 days a week. And then just a few years later, I stopped writing and started teaching. That became everything to me.
So how would you say all that you've did before is now, you know, feeding into what you do today as a yoga teacher, as a breath facilitator, as a speaker, author? How did the music and the writing is informing all of this?
I like your questions. The music is still part of me. I still write music. I wrote and recorded some songs last year because it had been so long since I had recorded songs. And I just wanted to do it out of love, out of joy for me. I didn't even put them on the internet because I don't want to confuse people. You know, I don't want to introduce a whole other side of me because I'm not trying to make my work about me. My work is about my students. It's all for them. And of course, I get meaning from doing that. I don't want it to be about my personality or my life. So, but I have a piano here. I play guitar. I write songs. I love doing that. And if you learn music, you learn about the feeling of emotion and the rhythm of it. And I have brought that into my class. When I teach movement, I can feel like a conductor in front of an orchestra moving them all together in the right rhythm. And I can watch them and feel them. So I'm responding to them. It reminds me of, I saw flamenco performance once, a Spanish flamenco, the real deal with one time. And it just stunned me. And one of the things that stunned me, Vonda, was the guitar player was watching the dancer. The dancer wasn't listening to the guitar player and following. The guitar player followed the dancer. The dancer was the conductor. And he would stare at her. And as she would speed up, he would speed up. As she would slow down, he would slow down. I thought, wow, that's a totally different point of view. But teaching a yoga class is more like that to me. So the students are the dancers. In a way, they're the conductor. And I respond to them. In terms of writing, of course, as you know, writing a book is very hard. I've written two of them, and I'm in the middle of my third one now. So I wrote 15 screenplays. And so that gave me the discipline of a writer. I have no problem sitting down and writing. I never have writer's block. But a screenplay is always a story, and what I'm writing now, as you are, is first person, and it's a very different format. So it's been a struggle to learn how to not teach in a story format, but as one voice for every chapter. So it's been difficult to change, but still the many years of writing film has helped me completely. It's all come together, I suppose, now. I'm 64 years old now, and everything that I've done before contributes. Even when I used to work for a bricklayer, a mason, I forget what you call that in German. I used to know the German word for it.
Say again the word.
The people who take bricks and make buildings.
A Maurer, maybe?
Yeah, Maurer. Genau. So I used to do this work for 1 year.
Wow, it's hard work.
It's very hard work, outside every day. But what I learned there from that man, I still use in my work and everything I do. It's amazing. A preparation. You have to be totally prepared and know exactly what you're going to do. Because if you make a mistake in that work, you have to get a jackhammer to break it apart. That's how you have to deal with a mistake. You can't make mistakes, so it's actually extremely precise and high stress work. Mm. So everything I think we do in our early life can contribute to what we do now, even if it seems unrelated. It really isn't. Nothing is unrelated.
I 100% agree. And I also ask you this question because I know that especially young people in this day of age where you have seemingly impossible, infinite possibilities, what you can do like for life. I think it's super encouraging to hear that there's no wrong path, you know, that it's not like you have to know exactly from going out of school what you have to do, and you can take some turns, right?
Yes. Yes. I think it's actually quite sad that a young person is expected to know at age 18 what they're going to do the rest of their life. I think it's almost cruel to ask someone to predict this.
Right.
And I think it would be better if everybody left school around 18 and took 1 or 2 years off and worked with their hands. I think everybody should work with their hands, like in the fields or a factory or with bricks or building every day. Everybody needs to know what that is like. It's because for the entire history of the human race, we went outside every day and worked with our hands in some way. And people should travel so they understand other versions of human life that exist right now around us. So we don't just think America, for example, is the only way to live.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's so important to reconnect to nature and to this planet, right? On
yes.
So many different levels. So, you wrote a book, but your first book was about breath. You gave an amazing TED talk about breath. Now you're writing again about breath. So tell us a little bit, how did you get into breath through yoga, and what was for you, because many people teaching yoga but not focusing on the breath, right? So what was it for you about the breath that really, where you said, this is my topic?
I was first introduced with breath, to breath work through Qigong. I had a very good Qigong teacher. And one of the things that's different about Qigong from yoga is most yoga breath is done seated, except, of course, the ocean breathing or ujjayi breathing done standing postures. In Qigong, most of the breathing is done moving. Or at least moving the arms. Sometimes the legs are still, but the arms move. And so I was introduced through this real vinyasa, is moving with breath, letting the breath lead the movement. And it used to put me in an altered state every time I did it, a positive altered state. So I learned the value of here, and also to work with physical pain in my own body from broken bones. I broke some bones later. My late teens, and I'm skipping over this long story. But anyway, I learned how to control pain with my breath. That's quite useful, as every pregnant woman knows. That's why they're using.
It's actually where you're just talking about it. It's actually something I want to share, is I'm right now reading a book about hypnobirthing, you know, and it's basically, they're speaking about techniques from yoga in there using while giving birth. So what I'm reading there is actually nothing really new to me, you know? So, which I was like, wow. I mean, I think yoga is an amazing tool or breath work to have in order to give birth. Right. So, but it's very, very similar. Like everything they say in hypnobirthing is very similar to what we do in yoga, actually.
That's right. So when I started practicing yoga every day, which again was later, I didn't begin practicing yoga till 35, on my 35th birthday. My girlfriend at that time took me to my first yoga class on my birthday. It was funny because she did it as a surprise, and I was so disappointed when she told me. She goes, "Guess what? We're going to yoga class today." And I don't want to go to a yoga class. Why would you do that to me on my birthday?
But, you know, what were your assumptions about yoga?
That it was a guru based practice. That it was a cult based practice, because the only yoga I had been exposed to was actually that, where they wore the picture of their guru and a necklace. and had his picture on the front. And so I thought all yoga was like that. Mm. And I wasn't interested in joining a cult, so I wasn't interested in going to yoga. But anyway, it blew me away. My first class was just unbelievable how I felt for the next 2 or 3 days. So I started going back. And then I started practicing 6 days a week shortly after. And I felt everything change. And I noticed that at the end of every class, when I was lying in Shavasana, I call it total relaxation, I would have tears coming down the sides of my face every time. And it embarrassed me. And I hoped that nobody could see me, of course, because I was this big, strong man crying, basically, at the end of every class. But I have no images or understanding of where the tears came from. But I knew it meant something. I knew it was important. And finally, I found a teacher who understood it, because the other teachers I talked to about, they had no idea either. And the teacher I found that helped me with this basically explained that they were old tears. They're from the past that were in the pain in my body from my surgeries, from my physical pain, from trauma, all the trauma I had had in my life, that's what was coming up. And this was amazing to me. And so I made even more of an effort to breathe well until I became a very good breather. People would put their mat down next to me to try to learn how to breathe every day. And then when I started teaching officially, I became known as the breathing guy. I mean, not officially, just people would say, he'll make you breathe if you go to his class. You go to his class and everybody starts crying at the end. And the reason was because of the breathing. And so everyone else would have a similar experience where they would just lie down and you'd hear people quietly sobbing as the pain was released. So this, I knew I was on to something, but I had very little understanding of it. And I didn't really like, Vonda, to be frank, a lot of the yoga explanations for it. Because to me, sometimes yoga leaves out the psychological element of the human being. And so I had to learn from other sources and from experience and from trial and error and innovation how to really help people with this. And this included inner child work, which I know you're familiar with. And I mean, we could talk about this for hours, so I'll just leave it at that. That's how it started. And I'll wait for your other questions. Or I'll just never stop talking about it.
Yeah, thank you for sharing, especially, you know, that so much tears came out in the beginning when you started yoga, because that's actually one of the most frequent questions I got asked. Yes. As a yoga teacher, is like, why am I crying in yoga class? Is that normal? And that's actually one of my own experiences too. The first yoga class I went to, I actually was trained as an actress, a musical actress, in singing, dancing, and acting. And I experienced in that time a lot of pressure. I had a lot of self-hatred because I wasn't perfect. And so I went to my first yoga class in order to balance some of that stress I experienced in ballet and in, you know, needing to be perfect and, you know, achieving perfection. So, so I went to my first yoga class and
you had a lot of anxiety then too.
Totally. Anxiety, depression. So I went to my first yoga class and I just cried, you know, I just cried the whole time in Shavasana. I was like, And that, I think, if you will never forget your first yoga class. I think it's just something that's, and I knew, okay, here's something for me, right? Like here's something that's really good. And so can you, because you study breath, you know, for so many years, can you tell us a little bit about the psychological side? So what is happening? Like you said, yeah, it's all tears. I like to compare sometimes the human body with a sponge. Like when you squeeze it with asana, with breathing, that, you know, everything comes out, like that you collected over like the years of memory. Would you say the same? So what is happening when you cry in yoga?
Genau. That's a very good analogy. we Some believe that the subconscious is in the body. I think this is probably true, that that is the location of the subconscious, which is why the body remembers everything. And any good body worker, massage therapist, will say, if you massage certain people in certain areas, they immediately start to cry. That's where they store this trauma from their life. And so, yes, when we move the body through postures, movement, this is extremely helpful. You add breathing practice in with that, it's twice as powerful or three times as powerful. This is what some people don't understand. Yes, postures are great. Add breathing. You have something amazing, absolutely amazing. Almost everybody I meet thinks, I have an anxiety problem. I mean, that they say, I have an anxiety problem. How do I get rid of the problem? And again, I say, anxiety isn't the problem. Anxiety is the symptom of a problem. For example, if I break my leg and I'm in extreme pain, I don't have a pain syndrome. I don't have a pain problem. I mean, yes, I have pain. I want some painkillers for a few days, but we have to fix my leg. And once a leg is fixed, in a matter of a few weeks or less, I have no pain at all anymore. You don't just treat the pain. And anxiety is similar. So we constantly
for our listeners, the Germans, just for the Germans, anxiety is translated, it's Ängste or it's Angststörung. Because I know that's not in the vocabulary.
Thank you. Yes. Angststörung.
Right. Yes.
Is a more accurate. Angst is not accurate.
Yeah.
And for your listeners, I define it this way. Fear or angst is a rational response, generally, to a threat in the moment or in the future. Anxiety is always from the past. That's why you can have a panic attack. That it could be triggered by angst in the moment, but it's from the past. And so it's from trauma from the past, always. And that's how they're separate. You can have both, of course. You can be very afraid and have anxiety from the past at the same time. So what is a panic attack? A panic attack is when the emotions start to come up from the past because you have not reconciled with this event from the past, but we try to keep pushing it down. We're wrestling with ourselves. We fight ourselves. We push it down. This is what a panic attack is. And you'll notice that when someone has a panic attack, they don't cry ever. They might cry later, but not during the panic attack. And in fact, if you would encourage yourself to cry, your panic attack will stop. That's how you end the panic attack, is allow the feelings to come up and cry it out, and then you'll feel better and there won't be a panic attack. But most people don't know that. So they fight it and they fight it and they fight it. So we have to, in my opinion, learn to reconcile with traumas of the past, to grieve properly. We don't really know how to grieve. We end the grieving too soon. So it's held in our body, and grief will wait for us all our life. It just stays in there waiting to be finished. That's why you can cry about something.
In German, again, for the Germans, it's Trauer in German, grief.
Yes, Trauer.
To be Trauer, you know.
Yes. Yeah. And grief is not the same as sadness.
No.
So grief or Trauer, we have to learn to grieve and to allow ourselves to be witnessed when we grieve, to not just grieve alone. And I can talk about that for 30 days. So I will stop there and go. Please continue.
No, thank you so much for bringing these so important topics to the table, this very vulnerable topics, you know, of anxiety, of grief, of depression. I mean, these are how you describe it, the skyrocketing symptoms of our time. So can you maybe I know you know some of the numbers, just like to, again, you know, make people or understand that this is like a symptom of our times we live in. And because people feel, sometimes I think they feel alone in, yes, in having depression or having anxiety or having panic attacks, and how many people actually suffer from that.
Yes. Well, it has changed a lot. Even when I started teaching in 1995, you might have three or four people out of 40 that had anxiety. Obviously, you can tell by looking at how they behave and move and their eyes blinking. And then up till before COVID, it's half the room. It's now, you know, it's just growing and growing. And they say my teenagers have it and my small children have it. This was unbelievable. When I was a boy, I only knew one boy who had anxiety, nobody else. So I'll give you some recent numbers. There was a giant study, a mental health study done in the UK. It came out in April 2018. It's the biggest health study on mental health ever done. I think they interviewed 9,000 people. Very comprehensive. And the results were unbelievable. For example, the worst one, I'll just get to the worst one. 30% of the people they interviewed said they had thought about taking their own life in the last year. A full third. And one out of six were self-harming. You know, that's where you cut yourself or do something else to your body on purpose. With 14-year-old girls, it was one out of four. It was even worse. And the youngest group, the millennials, said that they felt lonely. They were the loneliest section of our population. The ones who were online the most were the loneliest. This was before COVID. Now, once COVID hit, it spiked everything way up. In the United States, there is a back order for antidepressants now, and anti-anxiety drugs. They're not making it fast enough. So it's a big problem all over the world. It's not just the UK or America or Deutschland. It's everywhere I go, and I go everywhere. It's perhaps even worse in, for example, some of the Arabic countries where I teach. And anxiety is a huge problem because they're cut off from nature there. They don't get enough nature. And Deutschland has, if I may specifically address Deutschland, again, my father was from Deutschland, has additional national anxiety because after the war, they didn't ship in a bunch of therapists into Deutschland to help the people to recover from extremely psychologically complicated time and terrible time. It was just shut up and fix your country, go. And so when I talk to people who are, let's say, 35 years old, they say, my grandparents never talked about the war. My parents never talked about the war. I'm the first one in my family to talk about it a little bit. And so you have this additional collective national anxiety and shame, drama, yeah, that has not been dealt with. It's unbelievable how powerful of a country and how much you have done under those circumstances. I mean, everybody was traumatized by the war, but you had the additional stress of that you understand. I don't have to explain it, that everybody grows up with there, and very little dealing with it.
For sure. I think the collective trauma, I mean, each culture, country has their own trauma, but I definitely can see and feel that in Germany. You know, I sometimes call Germany Angst Deutschland. I know people won't like it if I do that, but I can feel there's a feeling of angst and guilt, you know, which is an underlying current. It's not, you know, it's not very on the superficial level, but it's like you're not supposed to be proud to be German.
Yes.
You know, that's like nothing you should be ever like, I'm German, be proud of, you know, because of our history. And that's, I think that's still kind of stored, you know, and a fear that something similar might happen, you know, or something might happen, like a feeling of threat. And for sure with COVID, it has gone worse. You know, the fear in general, for yes. sure. And of feeling threatened in a way. And so let us, I mean, of course, COVID is here and it's still there. We don't know how long still, but we have to deal with it. And so can you tell us the relation between breath and curing even anxiety, depression, sleeping disorders, all the symptoms we have in our modern times?
Yes. I want to say one more thing about Germany first.
Yes, please.
I just want to finish by saying, in my opinion, and the way I see it, is German people are amazing and have been through so much. And I don't believe that anybody in the world is responsible for their grandparents, for anything that your grandparents or even your parents did. If my father or mother was a murderer, I'm not responsible for that. And we have to live our life and do the best we can in this world. And it's time to celebrate being German, in my opinion.
Yes. Thank you so much for saying that. Yes, I 100% agree. And not only when the national soccer team is playing.
That's right. Yeah.
That's the only time we are allowed to celebrate our Germanness.
I know. It's a start, I guess.
Yeah, it's a start. Yeah, it's a start.
Everyone should be proud of who they are.
Yeah.
And where and their culture. And no hands are clean in this world.
No. So
okay, now. When you
what
breathe,
can we do about it? about this all.
When we do breathing practices every day, it helps us from accumulating stress. It keeps us from gaining new anxiety. If occasionally we do more cathartic breathing, like, do you know this word, cathartic?
Yes.
Okay. What is the Deutsch word for that?
Kathartisch or katharsis.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Exactly so. So when you do more cathartic breathing, this helps to access deeper the subconscious, which includes memory and the emotions that have been frozen, essentially, and the insight. The insight will come with it. So let me say it this way. Let's say that this man to my left here, this invisible man, had a trauma when he was 5 years old. But he was told by his parents, basically, he's not allowed to cry. He's not allowed to feel anything. You know, just shut up, stop crying, get over it. Let me start this over again because I can actually use a true story. So I know a man, he's about my age. And after hearing me lecture, he came up to me and he said, Max, you've known me a long time, but I've never told you that I used to have a sister. And when I was 8 years old and she was 12, I loved her more than anyone in the world. And she died. And after the funeral, my parents said, we will never speak of this again. That's how he was taught to grieve. You can grieve for 1 or 2 days and then you never even speak of it again, like she never existed. And so if I may use a little bit of poetic language to describe this, if you imagine emotion as water, he froze it. So it's like he has frozen emotion in his chest, this ice chest. And we put this armor around our chest. And in this case, maybe perhaps made of ice armor. Now, if I teach him how to breathe every day, that ice is going to start to melt. And the water will start to seep out of his eyes when he's lying in Shavasana at the end of his class.
It's a beautiful picture.
And so what starts happening is you start remembering. And he thinks, wait a second. I'm starting to remember my sister more now. Can I speak of her now? Because I've been told in my life. So now as an adult, I say, tell me about your sister. I'm going to sit here with you and I'm going to witness you cry and tell me about your sister, which you weren't allowed to do when you were 8. And when he doesn't go back to the way he used to be. There's a change in him that's permanent. The grieving process has been allowed to go, to move forward again, like a truck that's been stuck in a ditch for 30, 50 years, and now it can move again. And once he completes the grieving process, his anxiety will be gone.
Why do you think we are so afraid of grief?
We're taught this. I think we're very instinctive animals, more than we would like to admit, I think. We have a lot of instincts, social instincts, and one of them is even if you grew up with parents who said, it's all right to show your emotions, it's all right to cry if your heart is broken. But then you get to the schoolyard. You're 7 years old, 8 years old, and you find out, no, I can't cry here. If I cry here in front of them, they make fun of me. They shame me. They shun me. They mob me. I know you have this term in Deutschland, mobbing. So you learn very quickly in school that it's not allowed to be vulnerable, to cry, to be afraid, especially if you're a boy. You're afraid. It's the biggest insult you can get. And so that's where you're taught. And then when you reach puberty, you start to disconnect from your parents. You start to connect to your little tribe, and their approval is everything. And you're terrified that you can be pushed out of this group at any moment. So we learn to suppress what is allowed, what is not allowed. To be cool, you have to be cool or you're out. And don't be afraid, and don't be a baby. It's like we're still preparing for war all the time. There aren't, I'm not saying that everybody should walk around crying all the time. People ask me this, are you just saying I should just cry if I'm at work? I said, no, you have to, sometimes you have to suppress your emotions, no question. In an emergency, for example, suppress your emotions. But when the emergency is over, have your emotions. If you talk to soldiers who've been in battle, they will tell you privately that after the gunfight, they will cry. They don't talk about it so much, but they allow each other to cry. And then they button it back up again and proceed. But you have to grieve. The first thing we did, you're going to be a mama soon. The first thing your baby's going to do is it's going to inhale, and then it's going to start crying. That's the first thing that a baby does. So this means it's genetically encoded behavior. When we're frightened or we want someone to come to us to help us, we cry involuntarily. And yet we're taught as an adult, don't cry. If you think you're going to cry, go into your other room and be alone and cry there. Don't let anybody see you. Don't be a burden on anybody. This is so dangerous. This is so crippling to us emotionally. Because the beautiful thing about sharing our tears with each other is that it builds strong bridges of friendship. We become closer. We start to trust each other totally. It's like, I remember when I did this happened, she came. In 1 hour, she was there by my side. I can trust her 100%. I know who I can trust now after this crisis. Crisis reveals everyone around you. And so it should be bringing us together. And this is the most unfortunate thing about COVID, is that we're told to stay apart during this crisis. And we're told to cover half of our face so we can't even see the expression of the mouth of the other person that is trying to talk to us. So it's double tragedy with this crisis.
Yeah, thank you for speaking about this. And I think it's so important that we understand the relation between suppressing our emotions that are so-called, you know, negative emotions, as we label them in our dual world of good and bad. And we are not aware of what long-term disease can happen from really suppressing, grief, anger, and all these negative emotions, and how they come out another way, right? In form of disease or anxiety or depression, and really understand this connection between our mental health and the physical health. And I think it's still not yet really understood how important it's actually for our overall health.
Genau. You know, I recently spoke at the Inner Peace Conference here in Amsterdam. It's this beautiful event that happens each year, well, before COVID. And so I was speaking in this beautiful church in Amsterdam, this medieval church. There were about 400 people there, and I was talking about this subject. I wanted to share this with you. I said, well, first we have to define CPR. What do you call CPR in Deutsch?
CPR.
Heart, you know, the heart massage if someone has a heart attack and stops.
Missing it right now. There's a term, but I don't remember it right now.
Okay, so for your audience, CPR is what you learn to do if someone's heart stops. And you get down on your knees and you massage their heart to make the blood move until the ambulance gets there. So we call this CPR in America. Okay, so I asked this group in Amsterdam, I said, please raise your hand if at some time in your life you learned CPR. 75% of the hands go up. So very good, hands down now. Next question, raise your hand if when you were a child or a young adult, you were taught how to deal with your own grief or the grief of others. One hand of 400 went up. So what this means to me is if someone's heart stops, we know what to do. If someone's heart breaks, we have no idea. We're totally ignorant. It's just really a matter of education. We've been offered no education on how to deal with crisis. Yet life is full of crises. We will have others, but we don't know what to do with them.
And breathing could be a start.
Yeah, breathing is one of the important pieces. It's not the only piece, as like I like to say, but it's a tremendous good start, first of all, to start to deal with your own past. With whether it's national trauma, family trauma, racial trauma, and especially your personal trauma that you've had in this life. So that if you reconcile with your past, you'll notice your smile gets bigger. People will notice you seem happier. You're less reactive to life. You're a better partner. You're a better parent. You're a better associate at work. There are other pieces of this healing as well, which I've already talked about. But I don't know how somebody can live without a breathing practice. It just astonishes me. Because, I mean, that's why I think people turn to alcohol so much. You know, they use beer instead of breathing practices.
So can you just like explain briefly, like, because some people, I think, they don't understand why they need to learn breathing, because it's something we should know, right?
Yeah. I know. I get asked, you and I both get asked the same questions about this all the time. The primary function of breathing is bringing in oxygen and expelling CO2 and toxins. And so when we breathe well, it oxygenates the body and the mind at a very high level, increasing our functioning. And it triggers the relaxation response if we breathe in certain patterns. So instead of the fight or flight response, we're intentionally triggering the relaxation response. If we do this every day or almost every day, our body learns. This is what we do at the end of the day. We do our practice and we calm down. So we don't need to go have two beers because we're already calm. We already feel great and we look really healthy. But also, as I mentioned, the baby cries. That's the first thing they do. The other main function of the lungs is this air comes up through our voice box and expresses our all of our communication through speaking, through the sounds of our voice, the emotional communication, whether we're laughing or shouting or listen to children, all the sounds they make, it's unbelievable. So the lungs are not only for oxygen, they are also part of our emotional life from the very beginning, from the first moment a baby's born. And so the breathing seems to affect our emotional life, our memory, our subconscious, not only oxygen. People need to learn that starting in this moment, if this is the first time they're hearing it. This is why, I think everybody knows it once I say this, because it becomes obvious. A panic attack, notice how people breathe. It's a breathing event. They start, breathing very shallow and very quickly. You know, that person's having a panic attack over there by how they're breathing. You know, that person over there is experiencing joy by the way they're laughing, another breathing function. You know, that person over there, let's do this one. You're in a hotel and you can hear through the wall two people are making love because you can hear the way they're breathing. We know that that's also a breathing event. There's lots of breathing patterns that happen during making love. And you can go on and you realize, there's breathing going on all around me for all these different emotions. I can tell what my partner is upset when they come through the door by how they're breathing. It's like, oh, they sound frustrated by the breathing. So our emotions and our breath are always connected like a husband and wife. They're always together. They're never apart.
Yeah, it's so important to understand this. Is there a breathing technique we can do right now? Like, could you lead us maybe through a shortish 3-5 minute breathing technique we can do together now?
Certainly. I would be happy to. I'm just going to turn on my stopwatch here. I find the easiest one to do with just audio is the 4-7-8 breath, because anyone can do it and there's an immediate effect. The 4-7-8 breath is an old yogic breath that has different names, and it helps you to fall asleep. And since so many people who are listening to this have trouble falling asleep, this is a gift to you. You do this while you're in bed, in the dark, ready to sleep.
I have a question for you. Yes. Because I also teach pranayama, right? So holding the breath for 7 is quite long. So I got taught this is energizing. So can you say a little bit about this, the counts?
So this is what I tell my students in my teacher training. I say, if you have a breath that involves a metric, counting, don't change the numbers, just change the speed. So if it's too long, speed it up. So instead of 1, 2, that speed, go in your mind, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There, it's shorter. But the intervals remain exactly the same, 4, 7, 8. So you can make it as slow or as fast as you want. The more advanced you become, the slower you make it. If you're new to it, you can do it pretty fast. I'm going to do it fairly quickly now, assuming that people are trying this for the first time in their life.
Sure. Let's do it.
Okay. So again, for your listeners, this can be done to help you fall asleep, but also you can do it anytime during the day just to relax a little bit and trigger the relaxation response, which we all need.
I think actually no breathing holding when you're pregnant, right?
That's right. Very good. So if you're pregnant, I recommend not holding your breath or doing any powerful breathing exercises. Wait till after the baby's born. Also, I don't recommend powerful breathing exercises for people who have schizophrenia or who are in a very weak state. For example, if you had a heart attack 4 weeks ago, don't hold your breath yet. So if you're in a very weak and physical state, But if you're fairly healthy and you're not pregnant, let's go. I'm going to count for you. We will inhale to the count of four. We will hold our breath to the count of seven. We will exhale to the count of eight. And we will do this for only 2 minutes. Please, everyone, sit up very straight. You'll breathe better when you sit straight. You can breathe through the nose or the mouth any way you want. We don't have time to go over details like that. And to begin, just quickly exhale. Just exhale and listen to this sound. This is the speed. We're going to inhale to the count of four now. One, two, three, four. Hold your breath. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Exhale. One, two, three, four. Sit up straight. Six, seven, eight. Relax your face. Inhale four. One, two, three, four. Hold your breath. Relax your shoulders. Two, three, four, five, six, seven. Straight spine. Exhale. Very tall spine. Three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Good. Inhale. One, two, three, four. Hold your breath. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Exhale. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Inhale deeper this time. One, two, three, four. Hold your breath. One, two, three, four. Relax your shoulders. Six, seven. Exhale. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Inhale. One, two, three, four. Hold. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Exhale. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Breathe as you like and relax. Notice how you feel physically and emotionally. You may just feel more relaxed and a little lightheaded. You may feel some emotions come up that you've been holding down for a long time. That took only 2 minutes. The average commercial break on TV.
Thank you so much, Max, for leading us through that. So this is a breathing technique I can do every day?
Every day.
Perfect. Super simple, easy. And can you tell us a few of the benefits people will experience if they do that, let's say 5-10 minutes a day?
I don't think that, I wouldn't recommend that one 5 or 10 minutes. I think 2 or 3 minutes.
Is enough? Okay.
Is enough. So let's say you work in an office, do it twice a day during your break, perhaps, or pretend to be looking at something on your screen and just do it there and, for 2 minutes and, you'll feel much better. You'll start to relax. So you're not so tense at the end of the day. Then also do it in bed to help you fall asleep at night. There you might do it longer than 2 minutes. It might take you 3 minutes, maybe 4 minutes, but that's enough. There are other breathing exercises I would have people do longer during the day.
Amazing. So just 6 minutes each day.
Yes, 6 minutes each day.
can have great benefits, yeah, for you.
Yes. So many people have trouble falling asleep, and it really does help. I travel a lot, as you know, before COVID, to teach and to speak, and I cross time zones a lot, so sometimes my body's not ready to go to sleep. And so I use the 478.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I love, like, what I really love about breathing is that it's, you have it for free. It's always there. It's not complicated.
No, it's always there. And just a few years ago, I was promoting breathing breaks at work. I spoke on BBC Radio about this because I thought it was quite interesting. So I said, look, you have a certain group of people that smoke cigarettes. And every day they're allowed to leave the building about six times or seven times during their day, their shift. And the people who don't smoke have to stay inside.
I know. That's unfair.
So let the non-smokers go outside and do 6 minutes of breath work and come
maybe
back
next, here. Not next to the smoker.
No, no. Upwind.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Max. I think we could go on for hours. You have so much knowledge and such a, an encouraging life, you know, and thank you so much for your work. And I have one last question, which is if you could hold a speech in front of the entire world, nothing less, and say, you know, something to the people, like what you think everyone should know, or maybe some important life lessons for you. You can choose one or three, like whatever comes up for you. What would you say to the world, really?
I love that you ask me this so much, Vonda, because this is one of the questions I ask my people in the teacher trainings. I say, if they give you a microphone, you can talk to the world, what would you say? This is what a TED Talk is like, essentially. I've done three TED Talks, and it feels exactly like that, because you know that if you do well, if you really speak from your heart, you can reach a lot of people around the world. So today, you asked me this question. You're the first person to ever ask me this, and I'm going to just speak from my heart now.
Yes.
I'm unprepared for this question, so I'll just speak spontaneously. I would say that as difficult as listening to the news is now, or watching the news, I still have hope. It's easy to lose hope now in mankind, in humankind. But I still have hope. Because there are so many people like you. When I see your face, I see goodness in your eyes. And I see this everywhere I go. I think people are fundamentally good and want to do good and want to help others. And we need to remind people that they're good. And when we see them do something that is beautiful or kind, to tell them that we were witnessing them, we saw that. And that was amazing. And we believe in them. Especially those of us who are teachers or have gray hair or white hair, our words carry more power. We have to remember that. It's easy to forget. So when we tell somebody something at the right moment, it can change their life. If we see someone being a great mother when her child is sick and embarrassing her in public, and she handles it so well, we should tell her. We say, man, being a great father, being kind to his children, protecting them, or being very sweet to his significant other, we should tell them. Say, I just want you to know I saw what you did, and I think that was amazing, and then just walk away. And constantly spread the message of witnessing the good. There's too much witnessing of the bad, and there's so much mistrust now. We need to reverse this, and you and I and everyone else listening can do it. And to breathe, to do breath work every day, it only takes a few minutes. And learn three things. To learn to be comfortable when someone is upset, to just sit with them and not talk, to make eye contact, and to never be afraid of tears, yours or someone else's again. and we will have a different humanity. This is what I would say today.
Thank you so much. That was very heartfelt. Thank you, Max. So coming to the end of this podcast already, I would love to know, where can people learn from you, study with you? Also, your new book is coming out. Maybe you can say a few words about it. Breathe to Heal, right? I'm really excited. I'm definitely going to read it. So people can find you on a website, right? I saw you have amazing online courses also.
Yeah, I have a website, maxstrom.com. And it's not Max Storm, it's Strom. The R comes before the O. People get this mixed up.
I put it in the show notes. So they
Thank you. You can find out all about me. And I do retreats. I do live stream courses now. I do pre-recorded courses. I do a lot of things, so you can just find it all there. My new book is about what you and I were just talking about. It's called, for now, it's called Breathe to Heal. The publisher lets me keep this name. And I'm writing this as if it's my last book, and I have nothing to lose. So I'm saying exactly what I want to say from my heart, with no fear. And it's very difficult. I hope to have it out by the end of the year, as my testament and witness statement in this world. I think that's all. That's enough.
Thank you so much, Max.
It's been a great pleasure to spend this time with you and to meet you. And thank you for your really nice questions. That's not always the case that I don't always experience good questions.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm really giving my best as a host here, and it's a great pleasure, and I feel super grateful to be able to meet people like you through this platform, you know, really, and to learn, to get inspired, to be moved. You know, I'm really moved from our talk, I have to say, and I'm really touched. And thank you so much for the work, your passion you bring to this world, and making this world a better place with your work, really. And thank you so much for that.
You're most welcome. It's my honor. As I said, I truly mean that. And thank you for creating this podcast. It's not a small thing. It's very vulnerable for you to do this time after time. I don't think people realize that.
I can tell you. Thank you for saying that. Honestly, the interviews for me are the easy part. The sitting there in front of the microphone each time, and this podcast is now nearly 2 years old, is scares the shit out of me. Every time I sit there and I go damn, I'm going to share something really personal right now. This is super vulnerable. And, you know, sometimes I get feedback that is not always nice. You know, people don't appreciate necessarily that you're vulnerable, you know. No. And I have to deal with negative feedback too, and that's sometimes really hard.
it's so hard. I was saying for this, I say the internet has given us the ability to connect with people all over the world and be rude to them,
right?
That's the dark side of the internet.
I'm super grateful I can, you know, coming into your voice, which this podcast is also for me about, you know, showing up and giving a platform to others, speaking myself. So that's vulnerable. It's just what it is. And I think you just have to go into the arena and just deal with also what the negative sides. It's just part of what it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
And only listen, only take criticism from people who care about you and want you to do well. Take criticism from no one else, because there's nothing you can do to satisfy them. Only from people who understand what you're doing, believe in you. If those people have some advice, that's really, I think, worth listening to. The rest of it, forget it. There's nobody who doesn't have vicious enemies. I mean, anybody, Malala Yousaf, one of the most amazing young women in the world, people write horrible things to her. Gandhi, they wrote horrible things and shot him. I mean, all the saints, half of them were killed in horrible ways. We will always have people criticizing us or wishing us ill. So that's just unfortunately part of this life. I believe in you. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Max. Thank you so much. And I think it's such an important message we're just sending out, like in the end of this podcast, because I think so many people are not going out there, you know, not showing up because they are afraid of exactly this.
Yes.
Of being seen and then also having this possibility that people might not like you or might not like what you say. And I think, yeah, it takes some courage for sure to shine your light no matter how dark it is out there, you know? Yeah. So thank you also for shining your light, and it's so bright and in this world. And I think, this world needs many more lights. Thank you so much for bringing all of what you have to share, Max. And thank you everyone else listening to this podcast. Thank you for your time. Thank you for believing in me in this podcast. And yeah, have a beautiful day, everyone listening. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.